Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I'm very happy to be joined by one of my other co-hosts, the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com, as well as one of the co-hosts of the TV Break podcast, Alex Marcus. Hi, Alex.
Justin, I thought you were supposed to be the world's greatest detective. You don't know Spanish?
Alas. No, those lessons were way early in my educational experience. So, it's been a long time, unfortunately. Yeah. I don't know. Is being bilingual part of like one of those early, you know, detective kits that you get as a kid? Because I have a feeling Batman didn't have that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's really kind of remarkable, in my opinion, that he dropped the ball on El Rata. But we'll get into all that pretty soon.
Unfortunately, as the world's greatest detective, I've not been able to track down our other co-host, Noah France. He is unavailable for this episode, but we do have two very special guests. I believe this is the first time we've done this. Correct me if I'm wrong, Alex. But I believe this is the first time we've had two guests on in addition to the normal hosts. We are very happy to have with us from the Blurred Watchers and the Blurred Life with My Wife podcast, Courtney and Marshall Stevenson. Hello, folks.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah, no, we're very happy to have you. I've kind of just very recently started listening to your stuff and like kind of got an idea of your dynamic, and that was like a lot of fun for me. And I'd heard you as guests on, I believe, one of Alex's podcasts before. So it's really nice to have you on here.
Super excited.
Thank you. That's so kind. I know we can be a chaotic mess sometimes, but like it's all in good.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the vibe that I got was more that you just it just feels like I'm popping in on like two friends talking. Like that's kind of the vibe that I got from listening to you guys.
We've done good, babe.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate
the vibes.
Speaking as one fan.
I'm glad that's how it looks from the outside looking in. On the inside, I'm just like, what are you even talking about half the time?
Yes. But yeah, thank you so much. We're really happy to be here. Really excited to talk more Batman.
That's exactly what we... Oh, sounds like I'm echoing. Oh,
yeah.
Not anymore.
Okay, we're good.
Okay, sorry.
That was weird.
We are going to be getting into the Batman. That is the main focus of this episode. We're actually, because we have so many people on, we're going to be foregoing our typical full disclosure segment where we usually talk about other things we've been watching. But we have a lot of movie to talk about with the Batman. So let's get into it, guys. This is, of course, the first sort of rebooted version of this character from Matt Reeves in the director's chair this time, starring Robert Pattinson, Zoe Kravitz, Paul Dano, Colin Farrell in a role that I still am not convinced he played. I want to start. I'd like to start with you, Courtney and Marshall. Maybe I'll start with you, Courtney. What did you think about this movie?
I mean, overall, I was very entertained. I liked it. I feel like critically and like just people watching it, it got pretty good reviews. Like everybody seemed to like it. I didn't see anyone that said anything too disparaging, maybe little things here and there. But for me, I thought it was a really good introduction into this, I guess, new universe or this reboot of Batman that we're getting. I like where we're starting. Like, we're not starting from, you know, just he's the Batman and this is Bruce Wayne and he's that charming, you know, billionaire philanthropist. We're starting from like this almost angsty, just out of teen version. And I like that.
Yeah. What about for you, Marshall?
I mean, I definitely have similar pleasantries with the film. I thought it was really good. I thought it was really good. But of course, in contrast with my lovely here, I do generally assign the kind of 007-osity of Bruce Wayne. And I did kind of miss that from Batman's characterization. I mean, we saw Batman the whole time, but I do really enjoy when he is playing that billionaire philanthropist and he's collecting information. Mm-hmm. That's very much a part of his detective.
So you're saying you missed that from this movie?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But he's, yeah, like to Courtney's point, he's like fresh out of whatever age he is. He's still in the beginning. He hasn't had those realizations that he can affect the city from essentially both sides. And that's what we're seeing in this film, which I think is fresh.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, it's interesting what you say about wanting to see more of Bruce Wayne, because I've been rewatching the animated series recently. And I'm actually surprised how much of it is about his detective work and specifically as Bruce Wayne. So it's almost like he's playing this character who like acts like he doesn't know what's happening, even as he's collecting information.
Yep.
But I do think this film had a lot more of that than I ever expected. And so, yeah, I definitely see what you're saying. But Alex, I know that you're a big fan of this film. You might be, just based on what I've heard from Courtney and Marshall so far, you might be the biggest fan of this on the podcast. I know this is like your current favorite film of the year. So what did you love so much about it?
Yeah, well, it's my favorite movie of the year of the six movies that I've seen from this year so far. So
which is a lot more than I've seen. But.
But yeah, no, I really like this movie. And I have to say, I went into it with low expectations because, you know, I grew up loving Batman. He was like, it was Batman and Spider-Man for me as like my favorite superheroes. And like, you know, I was a Fox Kids kid and everything else. But over the years, you know, and I loved those Christopher Nolan movies. Those movies came out when I was in high school and they were such huge events. And, you know, The Dark Knight is such a classic. But in the years since that, I feel like my interest in the character has waned as, you know, other more toxic people have kind of claimed him as their own. I'm just kind of like, all right, that's fine. You guys can have him, I guess. And I'll just be over here watching Captain America chop wood. But unfortunately, that affected my, you know, anticipation of the movie. And then I like Matt Reeves a lot. I liked him from Planet of the Apes, and those two movies are really great classic films that I feel like have kind of just like been memory hold. I feel like no one talks about them, but in the moment they were really kind of a big deal, and I really like them. And of course Cloverfield is such a unusual classic. And but even still, it was like, well, they're saying it's going to be dark and it's going to be gritty, and I'm just like, haven't we done dark and gritty Batman already? And it's going to be 3 hours long, and that seems like a lot for the first movie, and I don't know. So I went in and I sat down, and I actually had the opportunity to see it on a Thursday, so like right before anybody else really had gotten to see it. And I was just completely blown away by like the first 10 minutes, and it just didn't stop. I love what a great feel this movie has. It just doesn't feel like any other superhero movie. It really has this sort of interesting artistic aesthetic. You know, AMC labeled it an artisan film, which I always think is very silly, because that designation was originally for like indie movies that they were releasing and distributing, and now they're just giving it to movies like The Joker and Batman. But I honestly can kind of see why in this one instance, because it really does have this great feel to it and this great look to it, and the aesthetic is just unparalleled. And Matt Reeves is just such an interesting director. He always puts the camera in a very interesting place. You never have these kind of like just locked in static shots or this kind of reverse shot kind of sequencing. It's always very interesting. Like we'll get into it with like the chase scene and everything else, but I just kept consistently feeling like I was looking at a movie that I had never seen before. And that's really hard to do for a character who we've gotten like over a dozen feature-length films about over the years.
Yeah.
I kind of like you, Alex. I kind of went into this with low expectations. And I was kind of like, even though I knew Matt Reeves was the kind of director who was going to take this very seriously, I knew that he genuinely cared about the character and that he would want to make the best movie possible just based on the films of his that I had seen before. I was a little bit skeptical. I was kind of like, okay, what is this movie doing that's going to be new? Because it seems like a lot of the same. And I was pleasantly surprised. It really, like, the best compliment I can give it is that I was watching this movie not really thinking about other versions of the Batman, especially on film, that we've seen. It was so good, I think, at establishing its own kind of rhythms and tone. And it also felt kind of like what you were saying, Courtney and Marshall, like I really liked this idea of like a younger Batman, but yeah, also one that's been doing things. Like he's been doing this, I was going to say job, which I guess it essentially is, but you know, kind of weird to think about it in that way. But he's been doing this. Yeah. Yeah. It's vengeance is a heavy business. but he's been doing it for about 2 years, I believe, when we meet him here, and it feels like he's still trying to figure things out. And I really like that the movie makes that clear without making it too explicit. Like he's figured enough stuff out, but he's still kind of trying to find his way a bit. And even more, you know, maybe even more pressing than that, he's trying to find his way as a person and trying to work through a lot of things. And I really like that the film seemed very aware of that. And I like that I could just think about these characters as they existed on screen without thinking like, oh, well, is this being really true to the Batman mythos? Like, is this really exactly what I want? I was like, well, I don't really care at a certain point. I feel like the movie can like speak for itself. And yeah, and I did like the aesthetic. I was surprised just the intensity just keeps ratcheting it up from scene to scene. Like every time you think you've seen like the scene of the movie, another one will come along that will just kind of blow you away just in sheer execution and technical precision. So that was really impressive to me. And, you know, I don't know. I've seen some people just say like, well, this is like the best Batman movie ever. And, you know, I don't know how we're going to get any better than this. And I don't know if I would go that far, at least personally. But I think the thing I can say is that it really did turn a skeptic into a believer. And I'm like, yeah, I would love to see more movies about this. Maybe not all the time. Maybe I need a little bit. After I watched this movie, I was like, okay, that was really good. I feel like I need to take a nap now, like, and maybe not think about this for a while and just kind of come back to it at a later point. Cause it's a pretty heavy movie, guys. I don't know if we all, yeah, you know, so, yeah, I really, but yeah, I really enjoyed this overall. And, I kind of like you were saying, Alex, maybe some of that toxicity was also, you know, a reason why I was a little bit skeptical going in. And that really doesn't have anything to do with the people behind the movie. That's just kind of the unfortunate reputation that I feel like this character and just other comic book, well, not even comic book characters, just major fandoms have unfortunately acquired over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think I wouldn't say maybe it was the best Batman, but I think it definitely has the potential to set up for probably the best Batman movie to come out, especially when he starts to really get into being the Batman and not being vengeance. So I'm excited to see what they do with him going forward, definitely. And I'm excited to see Robert Pattinson kind of open up in this type of role. Like, I know we saw a good amount of like what he could do in more of an action role in Tenet, which is why, okay, I believe it now. Like, I'm not just seeing him as a sparkly vampire. Like, I could see him doing like, being a charming, you know, billionaire that has this like secret double life. So I'm excited to see the direction he takes it.
Yeah. And I'm happy that we got I'm really happy that we got a pseudo introduction to Selina with this pseudo introduction to this version of Batman, because I feel like she's one of those characters that is, I mean, canonically she's very important to him, right? But seems to be that in other franchises we only ever really get to see her in an adjunct space or a smaller role deeper into the franchise. So starting off with her as his base and, you know, meeting her and I guess toward the beginning of his career would actually make more sense to me as far as the payoffs if they ever decide to follow some of those storylines, because now she's been there since kind of the early times. I mean, she's off to Bloodhaven now. Maybe she's getting better as an actual cat burglar. Maybe she comes back more developed and is able to foil or play off of the development of Bruce Wayne, said you know, said Bruce Wayne, if he were to develop even further as well.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to shift into talking about the two leads of this movie, Robert Pattinson and Zoe Kravitz, like, it's going to be a while for me because they're just so great. I mean, I'm a huge fan of both of these actors and have been for a long time. Zoe Kravitz is also the star of one of my other favorite movies of this very early year, Kimmy, which you can watch on HBO Max right now. Just this great little kind of like conspiracy thriller kind of send up for a Rear Window that she's just excellent in, and she's in like every frame. This movie gives her a little bit less to do than that, but everything that she does is fantastic. She's just so cool. She's like the coolest person that ever existed, I feel. Like when she just walks into a room and you're just like, yeah, of course everyone is like looking at her, and like, yeah, she's incredibly attractive, but she has this like great charisma that she can just weaponize in this role, and that makes it just like an excellent iteration of Selena Kyle as far as I'm concerned. Last night I just rewatched Batman Returns with Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman, and it's so interesting because that they're two completely different takes on the character, and I think they both work really well, but in contrast to each other, it really brings out the different elements of this character. And in this film, what Zoe does is she just plays her as this like classic femme fatale, which is just such a great kind of quality to bring to this role. I think in a lot of iterations in the comics we've seen her like that, but we haven't really quite seen her that way in film yet. Either with Selena Kyle in Batman Returns, where she's kind of just like this person who is just broken down the middle after a nervous breakdown, or the kind of whatever Anne Hathaway is doing in The Dark Knight Returns, which I like her in that movie, but it's kind of halfway between both of these roles, and I think that the extremes work better for this character. But yeah, she's just so. Zoe Kravitz is so fantastic in this movie. And I love that the movie doesn't just treat her, like Marshall said, she's not just like this like side character. She gets her own story. She really matters to the center of the plot. Like her moral kind of crisis is as important as Batman's moral crisis. And they really feel like a team in the same way that Batman and Lieutenant Gordon feel like a team with Jeffrey Wright. And I really love that. I love that. These two characters kind of bring out different aspects to Batman and Bruce Wayne, and also just kind of makes us wonder like what direction they're going to go down, right? Because of course Gordon is committed to kind of this reform of the city, and Selina is just kind of committed to kind of rooting out the underworld with more of a sense of vengeance, right? Which is what Batman is supposedly saying he wants, and it's really interesting to see them as like the devil and angel on his shoulder at the end of the day.
Yeah, I love that. I love that take. I love that comparison with Michelle Pfeiffer. And just, you know, we've gotten three main iterations of Selina Kyle now that we can agree to are the main iterations, in all respect to Halle Berry and that film.
Are we adding Halle Berry?
No, it's Michelle Pfeiffer, it's Anne Hathaway, and it's Zoe Kravitz. Not counting Halle, is what
okay,
I'm saying.
Okay, and that we're not. Well, I, you know, you can never forget Eartha Kitt, though. I mean, well, I know she was more of like
in recent years. You know, in recent years, we had the three main iterations. Sure. Can't forget Eartha Kitt, of course, from the 60s, right? But what they did with Selina Kyle's character in this film, to Alex's point, I mean, she's just radiant. I agree 100%. This was actually the most impressive performance that I've seen from Zoe Kravitz. I like her more as an actress than as a beautiful sex symbol that she is. I still think her mom is badder, but that's neither here nor there. I'm more
good company to be in, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you're two to Lisa Bonet, then you know you're still like most people's one, so it's cool. But as far as her acting goes, I'm very much more interested in Kimmy. I actually did remember seeing that trailer, and we watch these like trailer YouTubes where they collect trailers so that we can kind of see what's coming out and stuff. So I'm really excited to see that of her, and I'm excited to see the rest of her career as it moves forward. I'm actually more invested in her success and in her performance. Is now from this film, and I think
really
that's, okay. Yeah, I think that's a win.
Yeah, I was somewhat like I remember first like hearing her name, I think around 2015, which I remember she was in Mad Max Fury Road, and she was also in a film called Dope, and Have you guys? Yeah, like, and those are really interesting. Like, those were performances that I was like, okay, like, she seems like there's some potential there, but I didn't really feel like I got a sense of like who she was as an actor. It really wasn't until I saw a film called Gemini, where she co-stars with Lola Kirk, which is kind of this really interesting LA noir story, where I really got a sense of like who she was as an actor. And I was like, oh, this person's really great. I can't wait to see what she does next. And yeah, so I've been a fan probably since then.
I guess you're forgetting her famous role as Angel Salvador in X-Men First Class.
I was just thinking that. I was like,
I saw her. I never saw that because that was around the time when I didn't watch every superhero movie that came out.
Before you were given no choice.
Exactly.
And also, luckily, interestingly enough, if we're going to talk about her career for a second, she also played Catwoman in the Lego Batman movie, which a lot of people are remembering in the afterglow of this.
Oh my gosh, that's right. Yeah. Oh,
I was 16 years old.
I was going to say that was not on my radar at all.
the Lego movies. No, I mean, just seeing from where she came from as far as Dope. Of course, she had a small role in Dope. I wasn't able to see Gemini. That may be another one that I go back to. But just seeing her growth and just what she does with her time on screen. Because I feel like the Zoe Kravitz now probably could have taken that role in Dope and made it even better. Even though Dope was a great film, I really enjoyed it. It's one of my favorite coming of age California stories with kids and things like that. And Kiersey Clemons was awesome in that as well. I really love her as an actress.
Yeah. And the thing I really love about her here is, and like just the two of them together, it's obviously there's a ton of chemistry between them, but I'm hard pressed to think of many what's interesting to me is that the chemistry seems to be very much based on how comfortable and vulnerable that they feel like they can be with one another because they recognize the similarities between the two of them. I think when we think of like chemistry between actors, we think of more like sparks and, you know, like the exciting parts of it. And there's times where they can just kind of be like, just be quiet and comfortable with one another. And I thought that was a really like novel way, especially in like a big blockbuster movie like this. I thought that was a really fascinating way to view their relationship with one another. So I thought they really captured that really well.
Yeah, I love the way that Zoe, like, because Batman is the cipher in this world, right? He's meant to be this person that you could project all of your fear onto. But for Zoe, she has lived a life of kind of resolve and kind of scrappy, kind of pulling herself up out of the gutter that her terrible father kind of threw her in. She doesn't need to see fear in him. She sees this ally. And I think that that's really interesting because I think what the film is playing and what Pattinson is playing is kind of like, how earned is that even? Like, she's so desperate to have this person who she can kind of connect with on this level because she needs that, right? But is that even what Pattinson is? They certainly have a similar pain, but I think the way Pattinson plays a lot of those scenes is just this kind of like, he's in awe of this person and captivated by her, but can't quite be vulnerable with her because in some senses he sees parts of himself that he's not comfortable with in her. And then in other senses, he's just not a socialized person, which is a really interesting take on the character, right? Like, he's just, you believe that he's just been living in this mansion alone with Alfred for the last 25, 30 years and just doesn't know how to interact really with anybody at all because of the emotional damage that he has been going through. And I think that that's a really interesting take on the character too. And I just love the way that he kind of just sits, like, he's standing next to her and just so often just doesn't know how to kind of, like, it's just overwhelming. And so he just kind of goes into the most sort of basic of like, well, I'm just here to do a job kind of thing. But you know that there's so much more happening there that he doesn't even have. He just doesn't have the capacity to process, and he doesn't really want to process because it's a little bit of a divergence from his overall mission in the first place. And so that's why I feel like I really hope she comes back in later iterations of the franchise, because I think that she can pull out of him these interesting layers that he doesn't want pulled out of. And I think they like really did the work to establish that dynamic here. And I look forward to see where that goes.
Can I ask frankly, how everyone feels about the thought that this Batman is a virgin?
Someone said that?
Yeah. I feel like it's unquestionable.
he's like, oh my God, it's a girl.
That man has spoken to, I think, maybe 5 people in the last 12 years. And yeah, there's definitely no way that he's having sex with anybody.
The impression I got was that as soon as his parents died, he just retreated into the Batcave and never came out. Apart from coming out as Batman. Like when he does show up as Bruce Wayne, everybody's like, wait, oh my gosh, like it's Bruce Wayne. Like he's out in public. Looks like he's never gotten a tan.
Right.
Oh, well, yes, there's that. But I don't know. I didn't even think about that. I don't know how I missed that on the internet. That really never even came to my awareness to be like, oh, like it's first time seeing an attractive woman and he sprung.
No, I mean, there's a conversation to be had. I don't know fully one way or the other, but this one and that was interesting. I mean, this is not what you've seen or what you expected or what you're used to seeing of Batman. Right. This is a Batman who is, you know, green and kind of just like starry eyed, like in his presence with Selina, I could feel that he's like, this woman is way too much for me right now. Like, and it was such a fun dichotomy to watch and how they were able to play off each other and that chemistry that they were able to communicate so well, non-verbally. So I thought the performances of those two really carried the movie, and then having those kind of mini team ups between him and Selina and then him and Jim, and then bringing that kind of team together towards, you know, toward the second half of the film,
I can see that now, especially with his reaction to Selina Kyle when she was talking to, where we come to find out Falcone is her father.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, what kind of relationship did y'all have? And then like getting you know, jealous when he thought he saw her at the funeral.
Very juvenile.
And I'm like,
well,
that, but also you didn't pick up like the awkwardness of that situation where it wasn't like, I don't think it was the type of relationship that you think it is, sir.
Courtney, listen, John Turturro is the sexiest man alive in this movie, so I can understand why Bruce was confused.
Can we talk about his casting? I love his casting here.
I don't know if I'd call him the sexiest man alive.
Look.
I'm going to be honest. Like, I'm not normally super into John Turturro in that way. I think he's a great actor, but I've never found myself particularly attracted to him before. But in this movie, everything about him just like exudes sex in a way that was quite frankly shocking, and it taught me some things about myself that I didn't know.
He did have really good gravitas. Like, yeah. I thought he was very charming, and I love those type of villains where it's just like, okay, like you're the worst, but I could hang out with you. Like, we could have a couple of drinks.
Like, before club, like is we chilling? Like, what's going on? We playing pool? Like, what's everybody doing? Like, I'm just trying to be around, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, and he had that charisma as well. And honestly, I thought that seeing that from Zoe Kravitz and then seeing him, it was not surprising to be like, he's my father, because they both kind of had
it
was a great casting. I love John Turturro.
Yeah, and it's so funny because, like, you would, if someone told you, like, oh, John Turturro is playing Zoe Kravitz's dad, you would be like, what? But it works so well in this movie. How did that reveal work for you guys? Because in my audience, I saw it with, like, a very crowded theater, which I was not super happy that it was so crowded, but it was what it was. but when she was like, because he's my father, like audible laughs came from my audience, which is not how I felt, but it certainly was how some of those people felt. So it is definitely a big melodramatic turn that they pull. And I'm curious how you guys felt about that.
I was slightly surprised, I think, like, once it was said and I was looking, I was like, oh, okay. But at first, I have to say, and this did take away from me, you know, feeling like, oh man, he's really cool, I'd like to have a drink with him. At first I was like, oh, did he do something that, you know, is not so great, and that's why this relationship is strained, and like, are you like a disgusting old man, you know? But okay, good, you're not that bad, great, and I can see it, so it makes sense.
Yeah, I was fine with that. I was more amused at, you know, Bruce's kind of the way that he took that information. Like, he was like on some jealous boyfriend 12-year-old type shit, and she was like, no, because he's my father. And he was like,
and he could still be a dirty old man, because he didn't even know that he was her father.
No, I think he knew. I think he knew. I think he acted
at the end when she said it to him. He didn't act like.
Well, I think she made it clear, like, I'm such and such's daughter, yada, yada, yada. But he's seen her around the club. And I don't know. I feel like he had some type of creepy type of thing going, but he kind of left her alone, or just, you know, oh, you come around, yada, 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 yada. Hmm. Because he knew something was there. I don't know. Look, I feel like something was there.
Okay.
In his mind.
Yeah, I think that you get the sense that he treated her differently than the other people that worked for him. And especially that, like, when she comes to see him in the climax, she says who she is, and it gets her through the door in a way that I don't think it would have for one of the other girls. So I definitely think that he had this feeling probably that he was her father, but was never sure. And then when she says it while putting a gun to his head, I think he has an understandable reaction to the news. that was kind of how I read it.
I got a similar vibe from that. And I guess the moment itself mostly worked for me, even though I feel like in isolation, it does feel, because we've seen it so many times, right? I mean, the one I always go back to is like Chinatown, right? she's my sister and my daughter. Like, it's just, there's a lot of like, there's so many moments like that in film history, so it's hard not to maybe be taken out in the moment. But I felt like it worked here, because it's this, like, I feel like she's avoided really being that open about anything until that point. So it feels kind of like a breaking point. So I feel like in the context of the scene, it made a lot more sense. And there were some laughs in the audience. I did, like you, Alex, I watched it with a pretty big crowd. I feel like it might be impossible to see this movie any other way at this point. But it worked for me.
Yeah, I think that the way that it kind of is played is that he knows who her mother is, right? Like, he's known that for this whole time. And I think that he's probably always wondered if he was her father, but was never sure, but still treated her with a certain like level of affection because of who her mother was, and because he had this relationship with her mother. And then that final conflict, that they have, it exposes the truth that he always thought, but never knew for sure. That's kind of, I think, the best reading of it that you can have based on like what they give us in the film.
A much better way to put my sentiments, thank you, because I was tripping all over myself. But yeah, I agree.
Okay, I can come to terms with that. That's fine.
Okay. I'm a little curious, guys, what you think about this reputation that this movie has, that it's like very, very serious, because I found myself laughing many times through this movie, but found myself to oftentimes be the only one laughing during those moments. So I'm really curious what you guys think about if this is truly like a very serious film with no levity at all.
I think it's a specific type of humor, right? I think that you have to kind of have that same type of humor to see the humorous things that other people may not be seeing. The tone is very serious. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I do feel like, to your point, there were a couple of things where I was just like, okay, like, I mean, just the irony and with a lot of the Riddler's clues and things like that, I thought that there was a sly humor in that. His sense of humor really kind of held the movie's sense of humor for me, because, of course, he's a psychopath. He's a murderer. He's a serial killer. Right. But the way that he does it, and of course, you know, he's modeled after the a real life serial killer. I can't remember which one, but
They were saying that he was like the Zodiac
killer. The Zodiac killer, right. So like, you know, just that sense of humor for me. And then, you know, John Turturro's performance was just brought so much. Like, he's almost like not ashamed of anything he's ever done. He's like, yo, your father's life, and I took care of some stuff for him, and yada yada. And it's just like, it's so good. I really enjoyed Andy Serkis's addition as Alfred. Even though he had very, very few scenes, I thought that his gravity and what he's able to kind of bring Bruce back from the brink and give him, like, fuck his life up with some truth, you know what I mean? That kind of thing, spinning. I found some humor in that. I found some enjoyment, or kind of a little bit lighter, like, yo, get your head out your ass, man. Like, let's do what needs to be done, and let's not let you spiral down in this way, because your dad was indeed a good man. He did not know the men that he was dealing with, right? But don't feel like, you know, everything that you do is pointless. And I felt there were a few things that I feel like lightened the tone just a bit, if you had the humor.
I feel like you have to have a dark sense of humor to get the humor in it, because I think face value, it is supposed to be serious, but then you have to look at it like, okay, this is a young man who takes himself so seriously, but he's still, you know, getting into being this character, or being this, you know, dark knight, whatever you want to call him, vengeance. And then, but he still doesn't quite have it. So, like, when he jumped off, you know, the top of the police building, and he was doing the gliding, and then he like smacked into the bus and like rolled into the street, and it's dying. Like, damn, that's really fucked up. But I thought that was hilarious.
He should have had a broke leg, a broke back, a terrible concussion. Well, we're just sitting here, like, suspend your disbelief.
That.
Like,
just the fact that the grace wasn't there, and it's like he's doing these things, and it's supposed to be like, oh my gosh, this is so cool, like he's gliding through the air through the streets of Gotham, and while he was doing it, I was like, okay, he's going real fast.
This
is
was definitely his maiden voyage, and then, like, boom.
Did not make a graceful exit from that, or when he was starting up the Batmobile and it misfired, right. And it didn't start. I was like, wow, that's embarrassing. Like, stuff like that.
He was just like, come on now, baby.
right.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing that one scene where he takes out the glider, and I love that there was a moment where he's like, oh shit, I'm really gonna do this, huh? Like, yeah. I've tested this in theory, but maybe this is the first time I've done it in the field. And I thought that was a really good, moment. I mean, it's funny also just how much he gets knocked around in this movie, which, weirdly enough, like, is very consistent in the show that I've been watching. I'm surprised how much of a beating he takes in that show, and I thought that was true here as well. But even to a point where, like, all I could, like, at certain points after, you know, after he's taken out basically all of the Riddler impersonators in the Gotham Square Garden. Wow, I still can't believe that's the name of it. And all I could, so the thing that popped into my head was a quote from Arrested Development with David Cross's character, when he says, "Who wants to take me to the hospital?" I mean, it's like, I will say there's maybe it was hard to suspend disbelief in certain scenes. I mean, you know, when he basically, there's a bomb where he's right next to, and I guess he has, I don't know, explosion resistant chin or something. Like, that was maybe a little too much. I'm like, this is a powerful suit, but
he turns his face at the very last second. I feel like some people miss this, but he does turn his face. He doesn't back away from the bomb though, which is really a great choice by him.
That thing, you know, in his face, his teeth should have been in the back of his forehead. Like, no, he woke up on a table and he was fine. And I was just like, fam, come on.
I mean, he seemed to have been out for a while, at least. Like, they completely moved him from the church all the way to the police station, and enough time for, like, the entire police force to, like, circle around him on that table.
Yeah, all fit in that room. Very impressive.
He doesn't even wear a mouth guard. Like, it's I was like, all right, Matt Reeves. All right.
But in answer to your question, Alex, I do think I was surprised, like, there is a level of, I think I mentioned before, but just like self-awareness to the character. And I think I definitely take your point, Courtney, about he takes himself very seriously, and the film is very explicit about that. You know, there's just shots of him. I think the things I laughed at most at were just him, like, just bare chested looking at all these clues that he spray painted on the floor. Like, that stuff was really comic fodder for me, and in a good way, in a way that felt very purposeful. I also just liked, you know, you have this huge chase scene with the Penguin, right, which we can get into a little bit more. But just the aftermath of it is recognizing that, like, this might have been all for naught. Like, this, the Penguin's not who they're looking for. So it just, like, there was some humor in that. I do think maybe the self-seriousness, which I can't say is not there. I think I wonder if maybe if you had more balancing that out, like, you really do believe that this city is a cesspool. Like, I don't know if you have enough. I don't know if you have any evidence to the contrary to say that it's not. And, you know, I think the way everything is like it seems to be perpetually raining all the time, and not just like raining, but like coming down in buckets. I mean, it looks like, you know, a deluge the whole time. So I can't say it's not there, but there was enough self-awareness to it where I started to think, oh, OK, this is kind of funny. Maybe, you know, like, you know, in a darker kind of way. And it definitely finds moments to puncture that self-seriousness. And I would also argue that's maybe a part of the, you know, sort of Bruce Wayne arc in this movie, is him kind of trying to puncture that. And it helps that it's coming from, you know, people, especially Alfred, who I agree. I was really impressed by Andy Serkis here. But people like him who genuinely care about him.
Not enough Andy Serkis, in my opinion. I think that It makes sense to get him off the board early, so that way he's like that way Bruce is even more isolated. But I enjoyed the scenes that they had together, and like that is definitely a huge part of the humor, because I agree that like what you guys are saying, that Andy Serkis brings sort of an interesting comic quality to some of those scenes. But I also think that like Bruce is just such a jerk to him for no reason, because he's just taking himself so seriously, and he's just like, my pain is the only pain that matters. And so he's just like, like, there's the scene with the cufflinks when, it, like, Alfred's just trying to be nice, being like, you got to wear cufflinks. Here, I'll give you mine. And he's like, why do you even have those? You're not a Wayne. It's just like, are you 12 years old still? And it's like, yeah, he is. He's in this state of arrested development where he just, like, cannot kind of get outside of that kind of myopic kind of teenager quality to himself. And I think that the movie plays that really well. Like, when Alfred has, you know, also been exploded and managed to not get, at least Alfred threw the bomb away. He wasn't that close to it when it exploded, but he's out for days. Right. And he finally wakes up, and like Andy Serkis like looks and sees that Bruce is there. And he has this kind of like look on his face, like, oh, it's so sweet that he actually came out of his like cave to see me. And the first thing Robert Pattinson says, it's like, you lied to me. And I just burst out laughing, because it's just so ridiculous, but it's so Bruce, and that it works so well for the character. And I think that moments like that really help kind of allow you to not get sucked into Bruce's myopathy, and it really lets you kind of exist with a little bit of like criticism of this character. And I think that that's necessary, because he's a character who needs to go on a journey of like from kind of questioning where he's starting as this kind of person of vengeance who just goes out and punches people and tries to make himself feel better, to this person who maybe accidentally was like attracting the wrong type of people with his mission and realizes he needs to be more than that in order to actually affect the change that he's looking for. So I think that it's an integral part of that arc that he's going on, but it also was necessary to puncture some of the heavier aspects of this movie.
Yeah.
Also, like when Jeffrey Wright and Tim are in the police station and they're pretending to have this like tough interrogation while just kind of like making a plan and like talking about what's really going on. And Jeffrey Wright is doing his like all like tough guy face, but like the words aren't magic. Like, I thought Jeffrey Wright was really funny in that scene, and that was very effective. But yeah, so I ultimately I think this movie is very fun if you can find it.
I really just enjoy how superhero movies, quote unquote, are attracting this type of talent now. Whereas, though, you know, you get generally, if you get a good director who has a love for source material, good actors who take the role seriously, you can get a good movie. And the only reason, the only thing that I'm really upset about with this film is the isolation from the rest of the DCEU. This is, they made a point to say, like, hey, this is not a part of this. And it's just like, damn, every time we get a great Batman, it's never a part of anything wider. And I just feel like that's a missed opportunity. But I feel like they're like, no, we got to keep this shit away from us because then y'all going to get goofy.
I thought when they had the guys that were like the followers of the Joker, and they had that one boy who half his face was painted. That's the boy from Titans, which I was like, okay, that's a weird little Easter egg, I guess. Was that intentional?
From what I understand, I looked through this. From what I understand, he just happened to get the role. Oh, he just had, like, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, hey, we're gonna go ahead and put this Easter egg in. I don't think it was anything that deep. He does play Tim Drake on Titans. Mm-hmm. But
I think that he was probably cast in the Batman way before he was cast in Titans. And it was just kind of like because the filming of the Batman has been going on for years because of like COVID delays and stuff like that. So I bet he probably got this first and then got Titans afterwards. But I think he got cast just because he has the most expressive eyes that any actor has ever had, I think. So
he does have really expressive, like his looks, like you could tell, like, I don't really want to be here. And then, you know, you're about to shoot Batman, but Batman probably did something really good. Like, he has a whole story in his performance, which is amazing, because I can extrapolate everything that he looks and his physical. It's great casting. Like I said, you get good actors together, there can be this type of storyline, plot analysis, or theory crafting because of the performance that was so short, but very much overstated.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a silent performance. I don't think he has a single line of dialogue, but you really do know exactly what he's thinking the whole time. I totally agree.
He does, if I remember correct, doesn't he say, like, isn't he like the button on that scene of saying, like, don't hurt me? Like, because he's just
who says don't hurt me is actually the guy who Batman is saving, which I think is this kind of interesting, like, indictment.
Oh, that's right.
The terror of Batman.
Good point. Yep. I wanted to ask you folks, maybe, well, honestly, just kind of about the action in general and how that worked for you, but also especially like the big sort of action set piece of the film, which we have alluded to, of course, the big chase scene with the Penguin on, again, a rain-slicked highway. So what did you guys think about just the action in this movie, you know, in general?
I'll start with the outside of the Batmobile stuff, because I know Courtney has a lot of feelings about that chase scene, and it was great. But what here's the only criticism that I can think of, and this is not just this film. I think in our efforts to be more gritty, be more grounded, we lose the fact that Batman is like a world-class martial artist, and we've lost it for quite a few films now. I think the last Batman fight scene that I was really excited about was actually in Dawn of Justice, where he went and penetrated that warehouse of goons, mm-hmm. and he destroyed them, you know, with martial prowess and technology and things like that. But since the Nolanverse has grounded Batman in this way, he's very much like a kung fu, maybe a little bit of Krav Maga or some things like that. Like, you know, I kind of miss that with the Batman and his aura and his story of him being almost literally the most dangerous hand-to-hand combatant on Earth, from a human standpoint, at least. And that's something that I do wish that we were able to see more of. Now, of course, it's not as practical now because these suits are so heavy and, you know, they don't allow for a great range of motion. And, you know, it's hard, but it's something that I wish that, you know, somebody would be able to figure out. Otherwise, the action was fine as far as him being outside of the suit. I do like the fact that he has basically a bulletproof suit.
I mean, you really got to suspend your disbelief, though. He was taking,
he took a shotgun to the
chest. I'm saying, you know.
But I kind of like that because he doesn't he's not at the here's where it comes back to him being early in his career. He doesn't have the wherewithal to, you know, to engineer other types of things. Like, you didn't see him use his smoke bomb, or, you know, a lot of his gadgets. He has like this pouch on his leg, which I thought was actually pretty cool because it's more like tactical gear, but he doesn't use a lot of that. And it's probably because it hasn't been developed yet. So, I mean, that's just my take on the action. It was satisfying, but I missed the days that Batman would drag and kick you in the neck.
Oh, okay. My take on the action, I feel like it still always comes back to, like, this is a younger Bruce Wayne, a definitely a younger Batman. He's only 2 years in. I'm not as versed in like all of the lore with Batman, I think, as you guys are. But so doesn't he train for a while with like Ra's al Ghul? Is that correct? Who's he train with?
Yeah, I think it changes depending on like the origin story and stuff. But that is one of his origin stories, is that he like gets trained by the League of Assassins. And we actually see that in Batman Begins. That's kind of a big part of his origin story there.
So if we're going that way, although I guess maybe in this origin story, it's his training with Alfred, since he's supposed to be maybe an ex mercenary or ex like Royal British Army or something like that. Yes. So, but I'm just thinking like, okay, if we're going where he has to go somewhere and to learn how to fight more, perhaps that hasn't happened yet since he's still so young.
Yeah.
But regardless, I thought the action was very rough and tumble, and you're seeing him grow into actually becoming a fighter, where it's like, okay, at this point, he's just a brawler, right? I'm going to take the punches. I'm just hopped up on adrenaline and being young, and like the scenes with him in the beginning where, you know, he was just fighting and it's this whole group of guys and they're coming from everywhere, and he's taking some punches to the head, and even throughout the movie, and just him falling out of the sky and rolling around in the street and stuff. I'm like, wow, man, to be young again. You're going to feel that when you're 30, like your knees are going to cry. But like to be young and all your joints are great and you've got all that adrenaline. I was just like, all right, this makes sense to me. He hasn't perfected what his fighting style is going to be. So it gave some realism to me, which I liked.
Yeah, I fully agree with you, Courtney. That's kind of how I took it too. Like there's a real brutalism to his fighting in this movie that I think is really just meant to more express the emotional pain that he is in and the way that he's trying to process that through just like pummeling people and also taking hits, because it's kind of like masochistic in that way of just like, yeah, punch me, I deserve it, it's the only way I could feel anything, right? Like that's kind of the vibe of him at the start of this movie, and that's what makes it a really interesting contrast by the end of the movie, where he isn't punching people, he's saving people. And I think that that's really core to what the film is trying to get at with this character. So I think that it's mostly interesting in the fact that it really isn't an action movie, like not in the way that like the Christopher Nolan movies are, or even in the way that some of the 90s movies are either. It just like, it really, it has a couple of fight scenes throughout the film. It has that like incredible car chase in the middle, which just really was breathtaking for me. I just couldn't believe that they were staging it the way that they were. It was so exhilarating and just like unlike any car chase I've ever seen, in the way that Reeves placed the cameras like on the car and like inside of the car, and you like have, it's so disorienting but so viscerally impactful, and just like the colors in that sequence was really strong too. But yeah, overall it's not really an action film. It's really this sort of like psychodrama between Bruce Wayne and you know, the Riddler, and fleshing out this kind of toxic world of Gotham. And I think it really executed well on those objectives. If you're coming for a movie with a lot of action set pieces and cool choreography and stuff, you're going to be disappointed though. And that's why, honestly, I thought that the reaction to this movie might be more divisive, because I loved it, but it's definitely not the Batman movie that everyone is looking for. And so I was worried that maybe it wouldn't appeal to as many Batman fans as it appealed to me. But it seems like overall it's gotten a really good reception in that regard.
Yeah, people are enjoying it. People are, you know, it's like doing very well at the box office. We actually saw it in theater as well, but we watched it at a
movie tavern.
Tavern, yeah. And the people next to us, like, I guess, didn't show up. So we were on one side we had lucky. Some folks, yeah, but it wasn't as crowded. I mean, I'm happy that it's doing well. You know what I mean? I have very few actual criticisms about the film, other than, you know, the characterization of Bruce, and I just want to see Batman dragon kick the fuck out of somebody at some point in live action again. I just think that's cool. I think that's part of his character. And also, I do see Swain is more of a 007-esque kind of character. And, you know, I miss that as well. But I can see this movie being, you know, one of the best. I mean, right off the heels of Joker, which was taken very seriously with Joaquin Phoenix, I think this is probably not as good. Now, of course, I haven't seen Joker.
Right, you're saying that we still haven't seen it. So,
oh, you haven't seen it. Oh, okay.
Culturally, two people left on Earth who haven't seen it.
Yeah, we got to get on that. But culturally,
no, I mean, you could continue to not see it.
I know, I was gonna say, like, I'm like, yeah, you could keep it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, so me and Justin are not fans of the Joker. We saw it together actually and hated it very much.
Oh wow. Okay. We're in the right place.
But I think it's doing well because it's a fresh take. I think a lot of the people who are coming into, you know, liking the, you know, Marvel and DC and getting into these movies are younger as well. So I think it's giving people an opportunity to now grow up with Bruce Wayne and, you know, Batman. So I like the direction that they're going. I liked it. I thought that car chase scene with him and the Penguin was amazing. But at the end of it, it was also one of those things. It was like kind of darkly funny to me because I'm like, can you imagine? You're just like driving home from work. You're just trying to get home.
It's raining.
There's this big chase scene and you're like, what the fuck is going on? And then coming to find out that really wasn't even the dude that he was looking for. And then he just walked away and left him there. I'm like, you destroyed so many cars. Who knows, is flipped over and trapped inside of their vehicle. And like, oh, it wasn't you.
You're probably wondering how I ended up in the hospital tonight.
Right, crazy.
Well, boom.
Millions of dollars of damages and people messed up for nothing. So I thought that was hilarious. But visually stunning.
It was an amazing chase sequence. I mean, I love the personality of the Batmobile as well. It's just like,
it's definitely one of those, I'm like 29, 30, this is my muscle car.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's clearly like, you know, garaged, you know what I mean? Him and Alfred probably spent some time putting that bitch together on a Sunday afternoon and had some lemonade. Shit. And they were just like, it needs to be stronger. And they were just like, all right, cool. But I really love that. And just the cinematography of that race, the music, I didn't think that we would get better music outside of some of the things that Nolan had been doing, like with Hans Zimmer. But the music for this not only chase scene, but for the film altogether, the Batman's main his main sound and things like that, the Riddler's theme, everything was just so on point. Whenever it really brought me in. It was such an immersive experience as far as that chase scene, and I just appreciate it. Will I say that it's something that I've never seen before? I probably won't say that because I still feel like The Matrix Reloaded had the best chase scene I've ever seen. But also, I'm very biased toward The Matrix.
That is very good chase scene.
That is also a very excellent. That is a chase scene that lasts 40 minutes, and it could have been an entire movie, as far as I'm concerned.
The thing I liked about the chase scene is I really like the build up to it. Like, you don't recognize that it's going to happen for a while. Like, because I remember seeing the trailers and being like, okay, this has got to be a really important part of the movie. And I was still kind of surprised, like, when I realized where it was happening in the movie. I love how long it takes for the Batmobile to rev up. And how it also seems like it feels almost like a prototype version of the Batmobile in a very different way from like the Tumbler in Batman Begins, for example. And I just love the intensity of it. If I have some criticisms of that scene, some of the editing is a little bit, it was a little chart just because everything is like has this orangish glow to it and it's raining. Did I mention it's raining a lot in this movie?
a little bit, yeah.
There are some points where I actually was like, wait, is this the Batmobile or is this the Penguin's car? Like I had some just logistical issues occasionally, but the intensity of it was so overwhelming that I still was like very impressed by the end.
That's the word, the intensity. Yeah. And it was perfectly captured. That one shot after Penguin's car has been flipped over, Batman just like getting out of a semi-burning Batmobile, like, you know, he ran through fire or whatever, and that upside down, it really gave me flashbacks to Black Panther when Killmonger was walking into the throne room in Wakanda, and they kind of did this kind of like tilted, upside down tilted, and I was just like, this is a point of view, this is a perspective we need more of. We need more of this type of camera work that really is dynamic and allows these iconic characters to be seen in different ways, with the color and the backdrop and his silhouette being as perfect as it was. One of my best images from the film.
Right. If you could get an award for just like a shot like that shot from
Killmonger. Yeah, still, this still shot. Yeah. Oscar.
Yeah. I
think that this film is filled with those sort of like great imagery and I love the Christopher Nolan movies. I do. And again, like I kind of grew up with them as this kind of like, this is what a superhero cinema should be, right? But I do feel like this movie in its 3-hour runtime has more just like memorable, iconic images than like all three of Nolan's movies put together, honestly. It just like, it's so impactful the way that Reeves is able to express a mood and an emotion and just like an aesthetic just visually. And that's something that I don't really associate with him that much, because, you know, I don't like the Planet of the Reeves movies, or the Planet of the Apes movies are really, really great kind of technical marvels. And they have this great like emotional storytelling, but I don't really think of them as having like a very strong aesthetic. And of course, Cloverfield has this very idiosyncratic aesthetic, but that's all in kind of like the camera work. And that doesn't, you know. Yeah. But here it just like, you know, it's like a painting. It just, it's so, I just love the cinematography. It's the same cinematographer who was on Dune. And I think that really shows that his work is just kind of flawless. You really can't argue with it. And yeah, I also, that's Greg Fraser. And mm-hmm. I also think that like Marshall was saying, the music, Michael Giacchino's music is just outstanding. And it's like, you know, Danny Elfman came in with the Tim Burton movies and just gave this sort of iconic theme to Batman. Hans Zimmer, a decade later, comes back and kind of revolutionizes it and does this great music that just kind of defined a decade of blockbuster filmmaking. And then Michael Giacchino comes in and it's just like not what I'm used to from him, but so powerful and intense. And yeah, I love the music. The score in this is phenomenal.
It takes so much to make a great film. It's really a staggering amount of decisions and people, you know, saying okay to something that may not be exactly perfect in concept, but when it works so well like this, these decisions, like who, you know, I don't know if it was Matt Reeves making them or the production team or even WB. Like WB's executives have been infamous for their terrible decision making when it comes to these films and trying to control filmmakers. I really feel like this is the first DC movie where they just shut the fuck up and let somebody make a film and let them have their vision. And they said, okay, 2 hours, 55 minutes, do what you got to do. And the film is better for it. And I hope that we get more of this team or more teams like this and more of WB's executives shutting the fuck up.
Well,
and
let I feel people like who love
to make the movies make
Zack
the movies.
Zack Snyder kind of shut them up, right? Because like,
well, with the Snyder cut, absolutely.
Right, because if it makes money, it makes sense, right? And people wanted it, you know, his cut, and came out in droves to see it. And I'm sure, you know, they saw a lot of revenue from that. So now maybe they've learned their lesson. Like, hey, perhaps we should back off and like not make poor decisions. Another tangent that just came to my mind with Matt Reeves. I love directors that are loyal, because now that I was just thinking about that, didn't Andy Serkis played Caesar?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I love when they directors, you know, hold on to the people. Yeah.
Especially really talented folks. I mean, there are directors that continuously work with the same talent. And, you know, you see why, especially when you work well together. And we were saying this as well about Tenet and seeing how Robert Pattinson was able to play well in there. I would love more films with Robert Pattinson and John David Washington. I think that that is a winning combination in so many different contexts. If we could get John David Washington in the Batman 2 in some capacity,
if we could
the movie
get him
would be better
and
for
Denzel. Now, I know he probably wouldn't want to his father, but if it was Robert Pattinson, John David, and Denzel, and like maybe Denzel was like a bad guy and they had to play, oh my god, I would see that multiple times.
Yeah.
Or imagine John David Washington as like Harvey Dent in this new franchise. Oh. Like, I feel like that would be great.
Oh, I like that.
Winner.
Yeah.
Winner.
I hope they're listening. Please do this.
Winner. Yeah, like they need a new DA, obviously, because the other one got his head blown off.
But he's not coming back.
That would be amazing.
Can I just say, Peter Sarsgaard plays those kinds of simpering characters so well. Like, he does so many things so well, but this is like between this and like Black Mass, I don't know if anyone's seen that, but like he's just like the go-to guy, and it's so easy to see why.
Yeah, and I you know, he's
was he in House of Cards?
Peter Sarsgaard? I don't remember.
No, he wasn't. You're thinking of the guy from Ant-Man.
Yes.
Corey Stoll.
Corey Stoll. Yeah, they have a very similar vibe, especially in this movie.
I mean, I did this film was just incredible, and I'm just really happy about it because, like I said, man, when you let people who love movies make movies and not who love the bottom line, It really shows, man. It really shows. And, you know, outside of my critiques, I did enjoy it immensely. And we had a conversation and me and Courtney kind of disagree on the characterization of Bruce Wayne. But this is like arguing semantics at this point.
I think I think the personality is still the same. So I was just looking through my feed and I remember when I went to go see, I think it was The Dark Knight Rises.
Okay.
And there was a meme that was out where it was like just a characterization of Bruce Wayne as Batman with Alfred, and he was saying, "Well, I'm still gonna be Batman, but I'm gonna be mad about it." And then Alfred's just up his hands and he's like, "I'm getting real sick of your shit, Master Wayne." And I'm like, personality, like it's kind of like what did they say, once a man twice a child, like still that angst of him now, like even growing up, let's say this is the same guy growing up, he's still got that weird angsty stuff where it's like, please get over yourself.
I know Alfred in this movie was a couple of times once he got back to his quarters like, I'm tired of your shit, Mr. Wayne, like I can't stand your ass, like, oh, but you know.
Yeah. Loyalty. And I think that this movie captures that Bruce Wayne really well. And I think that it captures Batman really well. What it doesn't do is, like what Marshall is saying, it doesn't give you that sort of 007 quality. But the thing about that is that is the false kind of persona that Bruce Wayne puts out into the world. And absolutely, the character, right, as we see him now, isn't at a point where he's invested in creating that false persona yet. He doesn't think that it's necessary. He doesn't care about what other people think. He just cares about the mission. And I think that over the course of this film, we see that shifting a little bit. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the sequel, he starts to try to develop that public persona that is more recognizable Bruce Wayne. And I think that Robert Pattinson is very well suited for that more charming, like playboy quality. So I look forward to seeing that develop, but I didn't really miss it here because it felt like we were getting to know the real Bruce Wayne and the real Batman. And for our first film, I feel like that's all you can ask for.
And you know what? And that's what we were saying. And that's what I said. Like, I can't, it's an incomplete grade for me on the characterization because it's really contingent on how he grows from this. At the end of the movie, we see him, you know, out as Batman, helping the people, you know, becoming that, I guess, symbol, right? That okay, hope, because it's a failing war, right? Selina told him, like, yo, you can't win, basically. But he's starting to come into the realization, like, hey, you know, I can do things as Batman. And hopefully in the second one, like you guys have said, he starts to kind of get that, because we all know that,
I think that he
Bruce
will.
Wayne is the mask. We all know.
I think that he will. I think that maybe that was my only issue with his characterization, and not even so much just him, but the way that people reacted to him. Because even as Bruce Wayne, like when he was going to the funeral and things like that, or when he went to the club as himself, people were like really excited to see him and like, oh my God, Bruce Wayne. And I'm guessing it's because like no one ever sees him, but then it seemed like there was an affection there, which may be like a carryover from the affection people had for his father. But I was just like, why do people like him so much? Cause like he's a reclusive kind of jerk. So that's money. One thing where I was like, I don't understand where this love is coming from.
He's a Wayne.
Well,
I think it's like, why do people love like Angelina Jolie's children? Like no one knows who they are, but there's like this bizarre, like excited, like fascination with them. It's like, it's just because they're a famous person since kid. And the fact that they probably haven't gotten to see him because like all they know about him is like he was out with his parents, like in a public sort of fashion when he was a child. His parents died and then he just disappeared into his house for 20 years. So it's like there's all this mystery and this kind of like positive, like, oh, it was so sad that he died. And he's like this famous person's kid. And I'm sure that's really cool. And he's super rich. And, you know, I think that's kind of what it's going for. And it's interesting the way that in this iteration, Bruce doesn't really play into that at all. He uses it to open doors when he needs to, but otherwise has no interest in indulging that. And I don't think even really a capacity to indulge that at this point.
So I think he uses that to his advantage going forward.
Yeah, I got the sense of it being more like intrigue than genuine admiration for him. Really, because no one really knows who he is anyway.
Yeah, it's like that. Yeah, and it's that you saw years ago at that tragedy, and now he's all grown up, and it's like, oh, God, yo, that's Bruce Wayne. Like, I haven't seen that motherfucker in years.
Yeah, exactly. So something, I know we have to wrap up pretty soon, but something that we haven't really talked about at all yet is the Paul Dano's take on the Riddler, which is kind of core to this film. So I'm curious what everyone thought about that. Justin, what did you think? I know you're a longtime fan of Paul Dano, even in his more idiosyncratic presentations. So, and I know you also have very strong opinions on the character of the Riddler. So what did you think about him in this movie?
Yeah, it's funny. I think we had been talking offline recently about how when I was growing up, the Riddler was my favorite character, my favorite villain, I should say. And it's funny because I don't know if I feel that way these days. I think that was very much like 7 or 8 year old Justin trying to like just being like so taken by the sort of panache of the character. I mean, I loved and just the level of mystery to him. I especially loved his portrayal in the animated series. But I honestly went into this movie not necessarily expecting that. I didn't really know what to expect. I had heard that there were some comparisons to the Zodiac Killer. And I do, to your other point of Paul Dano, like I actually feel like I tend to run hot and cold on him. Like there are roles of his that I absolutely love. I still think people don't talk enough about his, role of Brian Wilson in the film Love and Mercy about the, late Beach Boys, luminary. And I think I like him a little better when he's more dialed back, when he's a little more subdued. And they're actually like, this is a character that is operating on sort of an operatic level through a lot of it, but he is doing it in a way that ratchets up that tension so well. And I think, especially thinking about the moments where he does choose to, I mean, explode, like just really, I mean, he is really like going for it. I do think it is interesting to me the way that he is able to build up to that. And I would say this iteration of the character to me feels very different from the one that I grew up with, but it's still that level. There's a level of mystery here, but also just the thing that surprised me about it was it seems like he really believes that Batman is like a sort of, you know, like a model or even something that he can harness. And that I'm like, I don't know if I've ever really associated the Riddler with that. And that's something new that I think the film is doing and doing fairly successfully. And so, yeah, I guess I would say just, I think it works for like so many other elements of this movie. I think it works for the movie that it's creating. I think that there are maybe some of those, like, there are maybe a few moments where I did laugh. I mean, how can you not laugh at Paul Dano singing Ave Maria so terribly? And at the same time, like, it's kind of like it makes sense for his just like warped perception of things. So I guess I saw it more as its own thing as opposed to a real sort of, you know, being really true to that character, at least as I remember him. But I'm curious to hear what you guys think.
Yeah, I think that there is a very valid reason to have a segment devoted to the Riddler's portrayal in this film, because it's so good for this film. It's so good for this film. It's so good for this universe. Personally, I will never not see Jim Carrey. I thought now, of course, I'm a huge Jim Carrey fan, but I thought his take on the Riddler was outstanding. Especially coming from being a 90s kid who's like, you know, seeing the Riddler in like this green sports jacket and like tights or whatever with this little hat on and a domino mask. And that'll always be my Riddler. Now, for this, I really enjoyed the fact that they took the idea or the concept of the Riddler and said, OK, how will this work in neo-noir? And I think that they got it on point. Paul Dano has the most punchable face I've ever seen. maybe not the most, but he has a really punchable face. And I really enjoyed that. And I really enjoyed his characterization. He's just an orphan who was traumatized and grew up and got into numbers and started seeing some inconsistencies. And he said, yo, this shit is fucked up. And he's the Batman of his story. He's clearly like, oh, I'm the hero of this story. I'm exposing this corruption. I'm getting these bad pieces off the board because they have done nothing but injure and mutilate this city, which I love. He is definitely, in his mind, you know, the best thing that's happened. And he's like, okay, me and Batman can work together. Like, I see what he's doing. And he really feels like in that interrogation scene that they're partners of some kind. And his psychosis is just, it's outstanding.
I don't think it's news to anyone that I love a good unhinged villain.
Yeah.
I typically love them when they're a little bit more charismatic and it's just kind of one of those people that you hate to love. And you're like, OK, super fun to be around, but also like you're totally psychotic. But I still think like he's unhinged in a way that I like as well, where it's kind of like, OK, you're clever. You're more than clever, and we can have this little fun banter going together, even though, you know, there's an undercurrent that's like really sinister. But also you feel like if I say one wrong thing, this person's going to explode. And you just have that anxiety of like, OK, what's going to set this person off at this point? I think he is a great mirror for Bruce Wayne or for Batman, because it's like you've got these two orphans and you can see where the divergence between what money will do for you and not having money, what that will do for you. And depending on what side, no matter like how close to the edge you are of that moral compass that you're on, how things could be different. Because to a certain extent, before he decided to flood the whole city, like, their aims were pretty much the same. It was just the way that they were attacking the problem. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it wasn't hard for me to see why he would be like, you and I are the same. Like, we're doing the same thing. You inspired me. Like, we're friends. We've been doing this together. And the fact that Bruce was so taken aback by that and he felt so like disgusted by it. I was like, it's because, you know, it's true.
Fucking your life up with
You're
some
seeing
truth.
Yourself.
Yeah.
So I loved it. I thought it was a great take. I think it's definitely different from, I think, what most people are used to with the Riddler. So I don't think it was maybe so very true to the character, but I like the take and I like how they were using him to put up a mirror to Bruce and be like, this is where you're going. Mm-hmm. So, and this is who you're inspiring. Like, you're not being as good as you think you are because you think this person is a villain, but to everybody else, you're both vigilantes.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. and everyone that he took out was a bad guy. He just happened to fully execute them and not that whole, I'm gonna beat them up and throw them in jail just so they can break out again.
Well, yeah, because he's not with the shits. What's your thing with Wonder Woman?
Oh yeah. Oh, I love Wonder Woman. I think Wonder Woman has a great motto. I've got these, you know, huge nemesis, and we have, you know, a big knockdown fight, and then they're dead, and that's it. And that's why I don't have these repeat villains like you and your like romance with the Joker and stuff like that. Like,
yeah,
you know,
like what would Batman be if he didn't have his one rule? And that I feel like is what the Riddler represents from a vigilante perspective. Like, no, they gotta go. They gotta die. You need to be destroyed, because otherwise Falcone is just going to continue to have control over this place, and it'll be a cesspool of corruption and darkness. And yeah, I mean, what else can you say?
Like, you know, he had points.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The logic was there.
Well, and so I also really, really enjoyed Paul Dano in this movie. And I think that he's giving such a great performance. And I totally agree with what you guys are saying about how he works alongside this Batman character. And I want to take it a step further by saying that I really think that it's very insightful about the sort of parasocial relationships that we engage with online all the time, and the way that, you know, these people kind of have like emerge into our culture as these kind of like, they want to be symbols of an ideology or of a way of looking at things, or and they want to put something out into the world, like whether it's on Instagram or TikTok or whatever. And then oftentimes they are shocked to find that people listen to them, but not just listen, but really listen and also hear what they want to hear out of it, and take things way further than they think they will, and then are faced with this choice of like, okay, I have this fan base now that are kind of toxic and unhinged, and what about me is bringing these people towards my message, like, that I didn't anticipate? And then what am I going to do about it now that they're there? Am I going to just embrace the fact that these people are kind of are associating with me and say, well, these are the people that respect what I'm doing, so I have to respect them, even if they're taking things further than I would like? Or are they going to show like moral courage and leadership and say like, no, just because these people like me doesn't mean that I'm going to support what they think that I stand for? And like, that's the crisis that Batman is facing in this movie. And I feel like that's a shockingly modern kind of question for a Batman movie to be asking itself. And I think that I would have never thought that the Riddler would have been the vehicle for that sort of question, but I think it's really well executed in this film. And I think you see it in that final confrontation between the two of them at Arkham, and you also see it in that kind of surprise fourth act at the garden where the Riddler's followers are kind of amassing to execute on their big plan, which feels very kind of, you know, I know that the like Matt Reeves has said that he wasn't going for a direct relation, like a direct callback to the sort of January 6th riot and everything like that. But I think that he is kind of tapping into the way that like online radicalization can happen and lead to real world violence, you know, the sort of like Pizzagate thing and all of that, where people just kind of get like a small, very passionate group of people get radicalized by a charismatic figure, and then they go out and make it real in a very dangerous and scary way. And that's what the Riddler's followers are doing. And I think that it's a really important kind of modern question that we need to consider. And I think it's really interesting that they had Batman consider it and ultimately use that as the means to push him from the shadows that he starts out in and into literally carrying the torch of hope and salvation by the end of this film. You know, it's kind of clunky on the nose symbolism in certain ways, but it's also great visual storytelling. And I think that I would have never thought to use the Riddler in that way, but I think that it's just so effective and well done.
Yeah.
So I know we're running a little bit short on time here, so I wanted to just give everyone a chance to maybe share any final thoughts on the film before we wrap up.
Before we do that, Justin, I did want to say that if you or many of our listeners like you are looking for a more traditional rendition of the Riddler, you should really check out the Harley Quinn animated series on HBO Max, because Jim Rash plays the Riddler on that show, and he is very much the kind of iconic version of the Riddler that you're looking for, with a little bit of a rated R language.
That's so funny, because I can totally see Jim Rash playing a live action version of that character.
Yeah, he's really great on this show, and it's definitely much more of a traditional take on the character, but a really, really effective one.
So, Marshall, what's your kind of final word on the Batman?
A worthy addition to the excellent collection of Batman films and takes. And I'm excited to see it move forward. And I just wish that WB had a larger plan in place to have films like this and characters like this and directors like this be incorporated into their into the group of these heroes, because while Marvel is just over here killing it on phase five, like, WB just can't get their head out their ass. And it's really it's really sad when you see films and characters and execution like this and you say, damn, can we extrapolate this? Oh wait, we tried, but we fucked it up. And you know, it's just sad, but I am looking forward to the Batman 2 if and when it's greenlit. I'll definitely be checking out the Penguin HBO Max spinoff and anything else that they do. I really, really want to see more of this world, and hopefully we're able to get Bruce's you know, his development in further films, and Selina and Commissioner Gordon, and, you know, hopefully see more of that Rogues Gallery and their take. I'm excited.
Yeah. I agree. I am really excited to see where this goes. I'm really excited to see Robert Pattinson's Bruce Wayne, hopefully with a little bit more sun, and let's clean up that hair and look, you know, dashing. I am excited also to check out The Penguin, that's that show that's going to be on, you said HBO Max, right?
Yep.
I, to the very end, I really had, like, there was nothing in my mind that was saying that this was Colin Farrell. You know, shout out to the makeup artists and the prosthetics, and I thought he did a great job. I saw him on Hot Ones on YouTube, and I thought he was just, he was so charming. So if you haven't seen it, I would say go watch that. It was a really good interview. And it made me want to watch more things with him. And I'm just really excited to see where they take this iteration of Batman. I hope that they do delve a little bit further with Selina Kyle and her just becoming more of Catwoman. I thought we got a good taste of her. That was really bad wording. I'm so sorry. I thought we got a really good viewpoint of where she is now, or in that part of the universe. I would love to see her more just like in her Catwoman bag. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about when you guys were talking about just how like charismatic and how she is on, you know, screen, especially in this movie, was just that damn walk. When she was walking through that club and stuff, I was like, damn. And them boots, it was magnificent. So I'm really excited to see really where they go with her. If they did a whole movie of just her and what she's doing when she goes off on her way, I would love to see that.
Yeah.
It was a really good time. I enjoyed this movie a lot.
Yeah, and as for me, I'm just going to echo everything that everyone else is saying. I think it's a really great movie. I was shocked to have found myself so engrossed in the film that I didn't mind the runtime at all. I know a lot of people have said, like, oh, it had too many endings. I didn't find it to have too many endings at all. I love a movie with a secret fourth act, and when I realized that that's where things were headed, I got even more excited. I just think that this is excellent. It's such a great foundation for the future, and it works really well as a standalone film as well, which I honestly, I've been rewatching all of the Batman movies and since watching this one, because I think it might be my favorite, but I feel like that's, you know, apocryphal to say. So I need to kind of like watch all of them again just to make sure before I say that officially for the record. But so I'm about halfway through and I've watched a couple of now first iterations of the Batman, and all of them kind of leave you wanting more and don't really work well as their own film, but do a decent job setting up a world. And this movie does both. It sets up a world and it works really effectively as its own film. I mean, maybe if those movies were allowed to be 3 hours, they could have pulled that off too. But I think that this is excellent. And yeah, we haven't talked that much about Colin Farrell, but he really is excellent in this. I still don't understand why they couldn't have just cast someone who actually looks like that instead of putting poor Colin Farrell in, you know, at 4 hours of makeup every day, as he said. But I also watched that Hot Ones interview and it is excellent. And I'd also recommend people checking that out. And he seems to be really loving it and really loving to kind of have the freedom of acting behind all of that facial prosthetic and makeup and stuff. So if he's liking it and I'm liking it, then I guess we'll keep doing it and we'll see where it goes with that HBO Max show. But yeah, I'm really into this world. I hope it continues. And I just can't wait to see what happens next. But most of all, the final thought that I want to end on is that it's very nice to see so many people with pretty bad taste in movies who don't know that Robert Pattinson has been giving tremendous performances for the last 10 years to finally get a chance to see that he is actually a good actor and not just the sparkly guy from Twilight.
I've had to talk to so many people that even people I know who just unfortunately don't watch a lot of the movies that I do only knew him from Twilight. And I was like, actually, you should watch Good Time or you should watch The Lighthouse.
Or The Lost City of Z. Co-starring Tom Holland.
You gotta check that out too.
I didn't see The Lighthouse either, but I heard that that was really good. And let us not forget that he was Cedric Diggory.
Yeah.
And right. Yeah.
Of course.
I was gonna say that is how I explained him to my parents.
Remember the boy that got the Traverser Cup and then
that's their frame of reference. That killed him.
But yeah, he's definitely, I haven't watched a lot of his stuff, but I have been keeping up with his career a little bit, orbitally. And I know that he's built himself up to be quite the character actor, and I'm happy for him, and I'm happy for him in this film. So I can definitely agree with that.
Yeah. And this is the type of role that could just eat you up. Like I've seen that, like when the rewatch that I've been doing, like I'm watching Michael Keaton, I'm watching Val Kilmer, I'm watching George Clooney. And it's like, these are all charismatic, interesting actors. And a lot of them end up getting flattened by this role because it is a very kind of unusual role where you kind of have to have this dichotomy, but you have to be playing all of these different things and you have to be in the suit and you have, you know, it's just hard. And I think that he could have really been flattened by it as well, and I don't think he did. I think that he really, really gave an excellent performance, maybe the most coherent performance of all of the Bruce Waynes, in the sense that like you really felt like you were watching one character as Bruce and as Batman. A lot of the times it feels like you're watching just two completely different characters being played by the same performer. And yeah, I just loved it. I loved everything about it. And yeah, 5 stars for me.
Yeah, I can't go quite that far, although I am curious to see it again. I'd like to maybe see it with some people who haven't seen it. That's usually what I do with big blockbuster movies. I was pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed it, and I'm interested to see where it goes. We haven't really, you know, mentioned the Joker in the room, but I don't know how to feel about that yet, although having seen this, I'm a little more confident that maybe they could pull it off and give us a take on that character we haven't seen before. So
I don't want it.
Yeah, I've been reading some interviews about this whole thing, because if you haven't watched the movie, I don't know what you're doing listening to this, but Barry Keoghan plays the Joker in a scene towards the end of the film in Arkham, next to the Riddler. And basically, apparently in the original conception of the movie, he was actually supposed to be in it a little bit more. There was supposed to be at least one other scene where Bruce goes to see the Joker in prison in sort of a Hannibal Lecter kind of way to help him like figure out like what's going on with the Riddler, and that then this was supposed to be kind of a payoff of like a little bit of a tag to that scene, but they cut that original main scene for kind of the, because it just ruined the pacing of the movie, but they decided to keep this. And he, basically I guess what Matt was saying was that he felt like you needed the Joker's presence to be felt in, so that way when Bruce is talking to Selina at the end of the movie and is like, I have to stay here, the city needs me, I can't go with you, it was kind of meant to help the audience understand, like, yeah, this world is actually really dangerous. It needs someone like Batman, because look, the Joker is around. He's in prison right now, but who knows what's going to happen. But it wasn't meant to be sort of like a tease in the sort of like MCU tease for what the sequel is going to be. And now they've announced that they're going to be doing an HBO Max series set in Arkham Asylum. And so it'll be interesting to see, maybe he actually will end up being more prominent in that. But I don't think that the plan is for him to be like the primary villain of the next film, which I'm glad, because I really don't think that Batman needs every single trilogy to be about the Joker. And I also don't think I totally loved what Barry was doing or how he particularly looked in that scene. So if we get less of him moving forward, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
We need a reprieve. Batman has such a rogue gallery of amazing villains, and this obsession, I feel like, for, you know, the general culture with the Joker and his story, it's a great story. I mean, he's iconic for a reason, but to your point, not every trilogy needs to have him prominently featured, and it really would impress me more for them not to utilize him and still make amazing film.
Yeah.
Well, we will see how it plays out. But we should let's talk about where we can find everyone these days online. And of course, I'll start with our guests, Courtney and Marshall. Where's the best place to find your work on the internet?
I'm the easiest. I'm Neo Queen Celine on everything, and by everything, that's really just like Twitter and Instagram, kinda. and then, of course, Blurred Life with my wife, which is our original passion project. And then, of course, Blurred Watchers with The Pop Break, which, of course, our illustrious producer, Alex, who reached out to us and got us involved with that. And we have to name drop him all the time. And we started doing it on Blurred Life with my wife. Like,
it's the new meta. Yeah. Yeah. We name drop Alex at least once an episode now. Where's Alex is the new meta of where you can actually spot him in an episode that we do. Otherwise, you can find me at the Marshall LP on Instagram, at Mr. Okami _7 on Twitter, BLWMW pod for the Blurred Life with My Wife podcast. And of course, make sure you guys tune in the Pop Break feed for all the amazing podcasts that you can find on there, and articles and work from so many talented people that we're so honored to be a part of anytime. But Blurred Life with My Wife is whenever we feel like it, hopefully more often, but maybe not. And Blurred Watchers is our monthly television focused podcast, which we are planning some content for right now.
How impressive was that voice change when he gets into his like commercial voice, just like promoting it? Did you catch that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Bill Bodkin, who's editor in chief of popbreak.com, he likes to call Marshall the voice of God and Courtney the voice of reason. And I think you guys should adopt that permanently, because I think it's a great way to describe you too.
Awesome.
Thank you.
But yeah, I love it when you guys invoke me on your podcast. It makes me feel very special. A lot of our podcasters are just like, yeah, whatever, we'll consider your opinions and then just ignore me. So it's nice that you guys, we have a nice collaborative relationship that I always appreciate. And Marshall, don't you have a Patreon running still?
Yes,
do you want to talk about that briefly?
Have the Okami Council Patreon. All of my Linktree, I consider myself to be a content creator, y'all, so I'm in a bunch of different shit. But if you guys follow me on Twitter or Instagram, you guys can find my Linktree, where you have links to the Patreon, the merchandise, my poetry album, Ho-Oh Tales, the single from Ho-Oh Tales, my media kit. If you guys are looking for brand ambassadors, we're always open to that as well. My Twitch streams, which I do at least once a week. So, yeah. Please check it out.
Oh, very
Marshall
nice.
Is busy. Justin, where can we find your stuff?
Yeah, as for me, so you can find my work on thecinemaverick.com. That's my website. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick. I have another podcast that I do with Noah France of this podcast called Podwork Angels, The Rush Hour, where we talk about the rock band Rush, going through the discography. We do that with Luke Martin, another Pop Rate contributor with Talking the Coda. But yeah, so that's where you can find me. And how about you, Alex?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow our show at Cinema Joes on Twitter. And you can keep up with all of the featured reviews that we do by going over to at Media Thinkings and clicking on my lists section in Letterboxd, where I have a list of all of our Cinema Joes episodes. You can also follow my work on thepopbreak.com, as Marshall and Courtney mentioned a few minutes ago. I am the podcast's editor over there, and also the co-host of TV Break on the Pop Break TV feed, which is a podcast feed that you can also subscribe to get Marshall and Courtney's show. And you can also subscribe to The Breakcast to hear my other podcast, Bill versus the MCU, where the aforementioned Bill Bodkin and I are going through the entire MCU, three or four movies at a time. Last month, we covered The Avengers and Captain America, the First Avenger, and Thor. And this month, we're going to be covering Iron Man 3, Thor 2, everyone's favorite, and also Captain America, the Winter Soldier. Marshall and Courtney have very strong opinions on a Mr. Steve Rogers, so I won't spend too much time talking about those projects over here. But yeah, you could definitely check out what we're doing over there on there. And if that's too many links and stuff, just head on over to thepopbreak.com and click on the podcast tab, and you'll see all of the work that we're doing over there.
Well, thank you once again, Courtney Marshall, for joining us. It was a real pleasure being able to talk to you. And
can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, same. But for now, I want to also thank our listeners and our subscribers. Before the Cinema Joes, this is Justin Mancini signing off.